Okay, wonderful. I want to thank everyone for having this conference. It's been a tremendous experience learning about all of these different aspects of shock physics. We've already learned a lot about what you can get from the Balmer filaments. Frank just did a great job of talking about how you can get constraints on distance and on shock velocity from that. In this case, I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can try to infer the degree of electron-ion equilibration from these shocks, because this is a rather important aspect of plasma astrophysics that is very poorly understood. And just to enliven things, I thought I would show up by showing you this little video over here, which kind of reminds me of expanding ejecta from a supernova, but this is a shock in the atmosphere that helps conceptualize what one of these is like. And you may hear a man with either an Australian or New Zealand accent curse near the end. I tried to cut it off at the right place, but you will be able to hear it. So here's an example of an atmospheric shock. So there goes the shock wave out.
Watch out for the shock, it's coming.
So I cut it off at just a millisecond in the right time. Okay, so, but what struck me when I saw this, I looked up this video because I was talking about shock waves to my high energy astro class. I was teaching advanced undergrads about this, and so I wanted to draw an analogy. And I thought of all this billowing smoke, and I thought, wow, that looks so much like supernova ejecta. If you take this and you go all the way around spherically, you get exactly what we saw there. And you saw that compressed layer of air that then came zooming by, and you had that large bang, and that was where the shock front went by. And so those kinds of shocks are extremely different from what you see out in astrophysics. A very interesting example of this, comparable example, is this case of 0509, where this beautiful HST image shows where the Balmer-dominated shocks are, and Frank and Sladiana have already talked a little bit about how those come about. I'll talk more. And you would think of the X-ray emission here from the Chandra image. This is like that billowing ejecta from the volcano expanding out in every direction. And you'll notice that this always bounds the outermost edge of the X-ray emission. So indeed, it is coming from right at the very edge of the forward shock there. Now, I want to just talk about a little bit about shock jump conditions and what it is that we do or don't know about how these sorts of shocks work. So first, before we talk a little bit about that, I would describe the physics of Balmer-dominated shocks in a redundant terms with what we just heard before, but slightly different words. So non-radiative shocks, these are ones where there's no cooling behind the shock. The gas stays very hot and adiabatically expands. When you do that, put that into partially neutral gas, you're going to get an optical spectrum that's collisionally excited, and this is all gas that is being excited as it is being chewed up and ionized away behind the shock front. And so you will actually have two populations of neutral gas exist. The slow ambient H1, by slow I mean if you measure the width of the line, it's not very, very broad. That gets rapidly ionized away behind the shock, while you form a fast layer of neutral hydrogen behind the shock front, and that forms up by charge exchange with the protons behind the shock. And of course, this also gives rise to pickup ions. And these are going to be these cold protons that now need to be swept up into the shock and join the thermal distribution. These sometimes have impacts on the line profile. Sometimes you see non-Maxwellian wings on the broad component, and Raymond et al. Have observed some of that in Tycho just in the last few years, and that might pick up ions might be a possible explanation for that. The line profile, this is just the classical picture. We now know it's more complex than this. You have a narrow component line, you have a broad component line here, and narrow line width should tell you something about what the pre-shock temperature is. And the latest work has been showing, people like Morlino and Blasi and et cetera, who have done these wonderful work here, is that the width of this narrow line can also be proportional to the maximum energy of the cosmic rays that are being accelerated at the shock front. The broad line width should tell you something about the proton temperature behind the shock, and that's what's so useful about it, is because that's where you get the shock velocity information from. The intensity of emission, the surface brightness that you get from this face-on shock, if you're looking at it face-on, is you just take the energy of H alpha divided by 4 pi times the flux of neutrals going into the shock, so number density times speed, and 0.2 accounts for how many excitations you have for it per collisional ionization. So one out of every 5 collisions is going to give you this H alpha. To give you a sense of how faint this is, if you work this out, it turns out the surface brightness of H alpha is something for typical conditions of a shock are going to be around 5 × 10⁻⁶ per steradian. This is extremely faint, as a factor of as much as 100 or even 1,000 fainter than a lot of the radiative shocks that you see. And so that's one reason why everyone beats their head against the wall trying to get spectra of these Balmer shocks and having it use a lot of time to do it. So one of the questions that we can ask with this is, if you have a shock front over here and here you have particles of mass mj, that's just an index, moving at shock speed v shock, what happens is that this distribution over here gets converted into a hot and compressed distribution behind the shock front, and that all happens in a very narrow layer. And at atmospheric shock, I just showed you that layer is something like the mean free path for viscosity in the atmosphere of the Earth, and it's really, really small, so you have a discontinuous jump. But if you were to try and use this with interstellar medium conditions, the mean free path for collisions would be something like 100 parsecs or more. So shocks out in interstellar space cannot be maintained by collisions. There has to be something else that is causing that jump. And so the question is, what is going on in here? With a strong shock jump conditions, what you have is the pre-shock density gets compressed by a factor of 4 for an ideal gas, and a post-shock temperature is 3/16 mv squared. And the important thing here is that this has a direct dependence on the mass of the species you're looking at. So if you have electrons and ions here, their temperature should in principle be just proportional to their masses. So the jump conditions themselves say that the ratio of the electron to proton temperature right at the shock front should just be 1 over 2,000. However, there are a lot of shocks out in space where you look and you see it's not that. Instead, it's something considerably higher than that, or it's even close to being equal, very close to the shock. And so nobody really knows exactly what mechanism it is that produces this kind of behavior. So the idea with these shocks is that they're moving very, very fast, and they're highly turbulent because we're looking at shock speeds of thousands of kilometers per second typically. What happens here is, instead of collisions, what you have is MHD turbulence at the shock is what gives rise to the heating. So you have stream kinetic energy coming into the shock. That's ripe for all sorts of plasma instabilities. So we're talking about densities and temperatures and velocities changing really rapidly and magnetic field strengths. That gives rise to waves, and that in turn gives rise to heating. So the nature of this instabilities to waves, that is where a lot of the work is in trying to understand how these shocks work. So just to give you a sense, Frank was talking about how narrow and how thin that Balmer layer is, and here's sort of an illustration of this. So if you use a shock speed of 2500 and you use the ratio of electron and proton temperature, I call it beta in honor of Morlino et al, who used that to talk about TE over TP. So if you start out with just mass proportional heating and look, here's a shock front and behind it is where the temperature is evolving, then your initial jump conditions are set over here, and then downstream the electrons and protons are going to slowly equilibrate behind the shock. And this layer here, this gray layer, this is where all of the H-alpha emission would get produced in a shock with these parameters. So you can see right off the bat that these two temperatures are not the same in the emitting layer, and they in fact never will be the same far downstream from the shock, because then you have adiabatic expansion and other effects. So here, your electron to ion Coulomb equilibration time is much larger than the age of the supernova remnants. So you start out somewhere near like 50 or 60,000 and then rapidly jump up to here, but then very slowly evolve, because the evolution depends on the difference between these two temperatures downstream. And this layer, to give you an idea, this is something on the order of a few hundred AU in not atomic units. We're talking about astronomical units. So very, very thin layer behind the shock. So qualitatively, what happens with the shock is that you have hydrogen atoms here in purple. Hydrogen comes into the shock front right here and is ionized away. And so you have this layer, this red layer here, there, it's ionized away. But the process of ionization involves charge exchange. So one of them is you start picking up a broad distribution here. And then there's collisional ionization, which just completely wipes out the slow neutrals very quickly. So you have this slow and then fast distribution behind the shock front. And as this ionization is going on, the number of protons is just monotonically going up. And so far downstream, you've totally ionized everything away. So this is where you have your emission. So here is this NASA press release, and it's based on the work that Frank has done and images of all the way around around SN1006. So I just wanted to show you some more examples of bomber-dominated shocks. I'm going to use SN1006 since Frank was talking about that earlier. If you look at one of these filaments over here, the white is where the H-alpha is located. Here's a couple epochs of imagery. This shows this is from the NASA website. You show, here's the Hubble image in 2006, and here's the CTIO image in 98, and you can see that they've already, there's been quite a bit of a separation between these two, so these shocks are moving at a very high rate of speed. And Frank also showed this. It's a beautiful spectrum, nice big fat broad component on here, H-alpha, H-beta, H-gamma, all the way down, and the next most bright line in here is right over here. It's helium-1-6678, and I don't know of any other bomber remnant when that's been seen yet, but that's pretty much it, and the rest of it is just incompletely subtracted sky. So this is what you have to work with. Some of the observables with bomber-dominated spectra include things that you can measure from the line profile. So here's a beautiful set of work that was done by Sladiana. So this was done earlier when her name was Nikolic. And what she did was she observed this with IFU, observed this filament over here in the northern part of SN1006. And so these little boxes over here, different colors, these show where the spectra were extracted. And so by going in here, she was able to extract spectra. And this is just one of, I think it may have been over 100 spectra that she extracted from along the surface of the shock there. And so what you get is you have a broad component and you have a narrow component. You can fit the two with your models, and you have 1, 2, 3, 4. Each one of these has a very different shape, and it's varying as you're going along the shock front like that. And so what you can do is you can take one of these, and I just grabbed arbitrarily this one here, and it has a line width of about 2,400 kilometers per second, so that's delta V, that's that width over there. Broad to narrow flux ratio, this is the other parameter that you can measure. If you take this fit here and divide it by that fit in flux, it's 0.77. So these two are the main observables that you can extract from your spectrum to try and limit what the equilibration is at the shock front. Now, given these two parameters like that, what can you do? Well, the width of the broad component, once you've measured that, and you can do that for H-alpha, you can do it for H-beta if you want to. H-beta is usually faint, so it's hard to see. That will tell you the post-shock proton temperature, the shock speed. Now I've added this extra variable here, which is really a result of the latest work from Morlino and Blasi, where they say the efficiency of cosmic ray acceleration is going to have an impact on this, because for a given broad component width you measure on the sky, if you want to map that onto a shock speed, you have to know the equilibration, okay, but now you also need to kind of know how much energy is going into cosmic rays, and that would enable you to map it onto a higher shock speed if you have some energy being lost to cosmic rays. So you have this dependence here on epsilon as well. The broad to narrow flux ratio goes all the way brought back to the work with Roger and John and et cetera. The ratio of those two go like the charge exchange rate divided by the ionization rate behind the shock. And these two each have their own cross sections. And the ratio of the two are going to tell you, or originally they would tell you, what the downstream ratio is for the temperature. It'll tell you the shock speed. But now with the newest models with the Italian contingent, we find that the temperature ahead of the shock now becomes a factor too. Beta upstream ahead of the shock is also a factor in determining this ratio. And again, once again, the cosmic ray pressure or the cosmic ray contribution comes in here at the end too. So here's the definition of what these are. That's the ratio of the cosmic ray pressure to the RAM pressure coming into the shock. So in principle, if you measure these two, you can put them together with this to try and figure out what your equilibration is. Now, once upon a time, this used to be a simpler thing to do. Back in the days when I had my Clugy models that I made as a grad student, I would put in the equilibration, the shock speed, and the pre-shock neutral fraction. And what I'd do is I'd measure broad component width, and then I'd say, okay, what range of shock speeds does that give me? Okay, for that range of shock speeds, what are the broad to narrow ratios? And I would calculate that. And then I'd compare those to what you see and see where they match. And it was relatively simple in getting the equilibration and shock speed, but now we've got these extra parameters in here that we need to worry about too. So things have gotten better, but they've also gotten a little more complex. So what I'm going to talk about here is some of the models that have been done. They've been alluded to by Elena and a little bit by from Slaviana, and I'm just going to summarize what those are. I haven't done any of the modeling lately because now this is beyond my capacity because I don't have that kind of expertise in kinetic numerical modeling that they do. So it's good to see that more capable people are doing this now. So one of the things you may have heard is that these models predict a third H-alpha component. And this is something that I didn't really know about for a long time and only relatively recently learned about. That there's something called a neutral return flux, which is when you have charge exchange behind the shock, some of these fast neutrals can escape back upstream. And of course, they run into the material that's coming in and they're gonna charge exchange again, and that's gonna deposit energy ahead of the shock. And so this neutral return flux, this actually creates a third H-alpha component. And so here are a few models done by Morlino et al. In 2012, and these were done with the neutral return flux, but there was no cosmic ray pressure included here for these. So here we have on this log scale, to exaggerate the profile here, the actual profile that you get is this black curve that you see here. So here at 1,000 kilometers per second, you have a narrow and you have a broad. But then when you move up to 2,000 kilometers per second, you start picking up this really noticeable intermediate component. And when you go faster, that component gets even bigger and more of the total flux. But then as you go to 4,000, it starts going back down again. Part of this happens because the charge exchange cross-section itself starts going down above 3,000 kilometers per second. So even as you make your shock faster, some of those protons on the wings of the distribution are going so fast, they don't do any charge exchange, so your line width is narrower. And so you end up getting this sort of non-monotonic behavior. And so this leads to these kinds of curves that you see over here, once again from Morlino et al. So now here's the beta downstream, here's unequilibrated, and here's all the way up to about 1. And here's the case where everything's equilibrated. So when they ran these models, they find that the typical width of this intermediate component can be somewhere between 200 and 300 kilometers per second, somewhere in this range over here, for shock speeds that are relevant to Tycho and SN1006. And these are our two favorite remnants, right? Because nobody can stop talking about them. So for that range, that's great. And it tells you that something rather important, which is that when you look at the narrow component in a spectrum, you may not be resolving it from the intermediate component. And so when some of the observations I did and others did kept finding anomalously low Braut to Noah ratios, I suspect in some cases the intermediate component was getting folded into the narrow component and we were counting it as all narrow. And so that was dragging down that ratio and causing difficulty with modeling the equilibration. So this is it's a really neat thing. And you find when you go down to lower shock speeds that the width goes down and has a maximum somewhere around shock speeds relevant to SN1006. It turns out way back in 2000, when I was doing my PhD thesis, I was working with Bill and John and everyone trying to write up this paper on Eschel spectra of the narrow component in Tycho. And Bill went in and he did his magic and he fit there's a narrow component. He said, hey, I need an extra component in here at 150 kilometers per second. And I said, wait a minute, that's not the broad component width. And he goes, no, the broad component is lost under here. This is some extra component that I don't know what it is. And so this extra component has been sitting around for a long time and people have been finding them more and more as they observe remnants with high signal to noise and high spectral resolution. They've been able to pick out more of these in other remnants. So this is clearly something that's important because if I take a low resolution spectrum of this, these are all gonna be blended and I'm gonna call it all narrow component. So one of the things that was done recently by the Italian group, and this is from 2013, was to say, all right, now suppose we throw in cosmic ray back pressure into the shock and we model how that is changing the shock structure. This is admittedly a complicated plot, and Frank showed it earlier, and I'm blowing it up over here. What I want you to pay attention to are the two red lines. So the thick red line and the thin red line are the ones that I'm looking at. So these two lines, the thick line, this is unequilibrated downstream, and then the red thin line is fully equilibrated downstream. And this tells you how the width of the broad component varies with shock speed. So what you have is this is a very good chart because if I come in and say, okay, I take one of Slaviana's spectra and I say, the width is 2,400 kilometers per second in here. I can drop it on here and I can draw a line through and I can see where it intersects these two red lines. And where it hits the thick line, I say, okay, in the limit of no equilibration, your shock speed is around 2,600. And the limit of full equilibration is about 3,900. So that tells me the range of shock speeds I need to worry about. And what's good about these curves is that they now include some contribution to pressure from the cosmic rays. So now if I decide I want to, okay, what happens when you assume some degree of added cosmic ray acceleration pressure? What you want to look at now, and I drew a line through these arbitrarily, if I take this line here, this is for unequilibrated and now going through the data points for 20% cosmic ray pressure. If I draw a line through that now and now say what is the range of shock speeds, I find that for no equilibration, now the shock speed, instead of being 2,600, it needs to scoot up to like 3,400. So you have to have a faster shock in order to explain your broad component width if you have some energy going into cosmic rays. So the effect of cosmic ray pressure is to basically boost your shock speeds. And that in turn, of course, when you combine with proper motions, gives you different estimates of distances, and it just really like changes things quite a bit. So I've just shown it over here for the case of the unequilibrated curve, but you can also do it for the equilibrated curve as well. So what you find though is that, I've sort of gone a little bit out of turn over here. I'll talk about more about that Brought to Narrow ratio in just a moment. But what I wanted to talk about was the models, the Italian models of the neutral return flux here predict something very interesting, because it's not just the width of that intermediate component, it's the overall flux that is affected too. Because the value of the equilibration upstream of the shock substantially affects how much total H alpha flux you're gonna get. And so here's a model that shows what you get for different shock speeds. Here's the ratio of the upstream flux divided by the total H alpha flux coming from the shock. And what you find is that for this sweet spot of shock speeds over here, that you can have as much as 40% of your total flux in H alpha coming from this upstream region where there's the neutral, the NRF is depositing its energy. And this ratio over here, this total fraction over here, it goes down as you reduce your amount of equilibration because the electrons get colder and colder like that, and so they're not able to excite H alpha as effectively. But this is important. Here's a plot that shows how this works. So here's one of their models for all this range of shock speeds over here, and this shows what the neutrals are doing behind the shock as you go away. They're getting ionized away, sure, but what you find is that whenever you have the upstream and downstream betas equal to one, equilibration is equal to one, you'll get this extended region out ahead of the shock where the distances are negative. You pick up this yellow region over here where now you've got H alpha being emitted from here. And so now when you observe one of these filaments with a spectrograph, you're taking in all of this and you have this added component that was not included before. If on the other hand you say you take your downstream temperature to be just that of non-equilibrium, then you end up losing a lot of that emission that goes ahead of the shock. So for these two different limits over here, you get very different contributions to the total H alpha flux coming from the precursor. So having said that, Morlino et al. Went, and again, I'm jumping back and forth between models that have some cosmic ray acceleration in them and neutral return current in other cases where it's only neutral return current. Well, here the neutral return current case is shown for Morlino et al. For the Brought to Narrow ratio. And this includes now that intermediate component. So if we have a spectral resolution of about 150 kilometers per second and we observe a Balmer-dominated shock, the narrow and the intermediate component will get blended together. And so the ratio of these two are what's plotted over here. And so here's the range of shock speeds and here's the various equilibrations downstream. And so what you find is if I come with, here's SN1006 and here's Slaniano's data again, 0.77, and I draw a line through there, I find it intersects all these curves for possible downstream equilibrations. But how do I tell which one of them is correct? And the answer is that, and I'm gonna tell you why I'm cheating here in just a moment, but the answer is that, well, if you take the Chandra proper motions and shock speeds from Katsuda et al.'s proper motion study of SN1006, and these are all coming from this region here, from T1 and T2 from this region, sorry, actually here and here. These proper motions, and here's the H-alpha filament over here, these proper motions over here have been measured by Katsuda et al., and they've translated that into an actual shock speed, okay? And if you take that and put those range of shock speeds in here like that, then you find, okay, your Bronson-error ratio is consistent with either no equilibration or about 10% equilibration. It's not the most satisfactory state, and I'll tell you why. It's actually very unsatisfactory because this is circular logic. It turns out that the proper motions in the X-ray were turned into velocities by knowing the distance. And the distance was gotten from the optical spectra that we took back in 2002, so it's kind of, this is all circular. So there has to be some other way to come in and constrain the range of shock speed so we can decide which of the equilibrations applies here. I found it interesting, Frank just said that SN1006 is moving closer. It's not 2 kiloparsecs, but 1.6 to 1.7. If that's the case, then I think these shock speeds are gonna go down, and then it's gonna get more complicated. So these models are wonderful, but in terms of turning them into equilibrations, it's not quite as seemingly straightforward as it was before. So I want to now talk just a little bit about the trends in equilibration that we see. So here's a plot that was made. The data, these came from a table by Van Adelsberg et al. And the Van Adelsberg et al. Models, they don't include the neutral return flux or the cosmic ray pressure. And so these are models that are a little bit earlier, but these data points, a lot of these with their error bars came straight out of his paper. So here are some various Bronson-error ratios that have been equilibrations that have been measured for different shock speeds running along here. Cygnus loop is all the way up here. It's not actually in this plot, but it's up here at about 1. This was what we found from modeling the Balmer spectra of the Cygnus loop. And as we go to higher and higher shock speeds, we find that, yes, there's large error bars, but these numbers, they come down and down, and they seem to, right around 2,000 kilometers per second, they seem to hit this minimum. But one of the problems is trying to measure these equilibrations above 2,000 is very hard because your broad component gets very faint. It's intrinsically very, very faint and broad. And so the error bars get really large, but one wonders whether there is some possible turn up over here beyond 2,000 kilometers per second back up to higher heating. Not sure. This, certainly you cannot make a case based on this, but it's intriguing to think about. But this decline over here that we see with shock speed is something which we would like to try and explain. And it looks like a 1 over a V shock squared is the best relation that goes through all those points. If you choose something steeper or something shallower, it doesn't go through the points as well. And Van Adelsberg et al. Did an analysis on this too, and it came to the same conclusion. So the idea is that your electron temperature at the shock, how do we produce this 1 over V squared? Well, the electron temperature at the shock is whatever it got from the jump conditions plus some extra bit of heating, all divided by whatever the protons got from the shock jump conditions. And when you're looking at fast shocks, this is very small. So this ends up being something like delta E over V shock squared. If that's constant, then you just have 1 over V shock squared. So the idea here is that you can get this if you posit that the electrons get a constant amount of heating in these shocks, regardless of the magnetic field or the shock speed. Once you're fast, they get a kind of comparable amount of heating in all the shocks. And this in turn, one possibility that we suggested is that this may actually indicate that this heating is happening due to something ahead of the shock and not behind it, where all the post-shock compression and other things are coming in. So the picture that we've just put forth as an idea is, if you look at the shock as being this idealized structure over here, if you now include reflected cosmic rays, so now you have cosmic rays that are streaming out ahead of the shock, highly relativistic, you pick up this precursor here. And the length of this precursor, the depth of that, is proportional to the highest energy of the cosmic rays that exist in the shock. And that length over there is proportional to the diffusion coefficient for cosmic rays divided by the shock speed. So this diffusion coefficient depends on momentum. So the bigger the momentum is, the more diffusion you have. And so one possibility is that something is going on in here ahead of the shock that is giving the electrons this extra bit of heating right before they go into the shock front. So here's a diagram that was presented by Rakowski et al. In 2008. And the idea is, well, how do you get this trend? Well, one possibility, and this was not invoked just out of the blue. Lower hybrid wave heating is actually observed in the solar wind and shocks that are around comets. And this is Martin Lamming looked at that and said, well, how about we try and adapt that for supernova remnants? And the idea is that if your cosmic wave precursor might be able to harbor some lower hybrid waves under certain conditions. So the idea is that if you have a shock front over here, and you imagine you're looking at a parallel shock, lower hybrid waves need to have a perpendicular shock in order to heat the electrons. It can't be parallel. So how do you convert a parallel shock, one parallel to the shock speed, into something perpendicular? Well, the numerical simulations have shown that the cosmic rays streaming out ahead of the shock, they give rise to Alfvén waves. And these Alfvén waves, they can grow exponentially in under the right conditions. And so this shows a purely exponentially growing mode of Alfvén waves. So you get a amplification of B like this that actually gives rise to a perpendicular component to it. And this is actually based, a lot of this is based on numerical simulations that have been done by Riquelme and Spakovsky and others who have studied this. And they found, as well as others who have found, that the this perpendicular component can be produced. So the idea with lower hybrid waves is that the electron heating happens in a very, very thin layer ahead of the shock. And the waves, they actually propagate like this ahead of the shock, but they heat the electrons along the magnetic field lines. So the heating of the lower hybrid waves happens along those magnetic field lines, even as it's propagating perpendicular to them. Another case over here is where if it's already perpendicular, then the magnetic field gets amplified like this. And again, that's a direction of your amplification, and the hybrid waves want to propagate perpendicular to that, but they heat along those field lines. So within this very thin layer, and I think the numbers that we had were something on the order of 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 centimeters, like really, really small length scale like that. If you calculate how much energy the electrons get from these waves, you will end up getting something that is approximately constant with shock speed. And this relies on the assumption that the cosmic ray diffusion coefficient here is in the Bohm limit, goes as 1 over b, I should actually say delta b here, and that it reduces to this expression here. So here your frequency here, this is the electron gyro frequency in that amplified wave. And so if you work out the details, and this is in the papers, your number comes out to about 0.3 keV, regardless of what the shock speed is. Now, if you put that in there in the top of that expression, you can get 1 over v squared. There are also some measurements, and maybe what I'll do is I'll talk a little bit about this after my talk is done. I'll run ahead of it. There's measurements in the solar wind of this as well. What I want to just talk about is a few new observations that have been done. Some of the really nice new work has been done by John Raymond and by Amber Medina. And so Amber wrote this paper a couple of years ago on positions within the northeastern Cygnus loop, where they had taken a shell spectra, they had placed slits all along the bomber-dominated shocks, and they were able to measure broad component widths along the filaments. And so what you find is these are very interesting results, because the outermost filament here has a broad component width of about 300. So this is lower, factor of 10 lower than anything you see in SN1006. The one that's slightly inside of that is 270, and the one that is the farthest inside has 140. So you see this sort of difference in the shock speeds. You can tell that whole shock front is being slowed as it's running into a density gradient. What's interesting about this is that the broad to narrow ratios over here that we're measuring, and these are lower than anything that comes out of any of the models that I've run, and I've never been able to explain them. And one of the difficulties is that these broad to narrow ratios have also not been calculated by anyone else, because everyone's been focused on SN1006 and Tycho. No one's been looking at Cygnus loop and slower shocks. Everyone's been going from 1,000 kilometers per second and higher. So this is definitely a sore need, is to estimate those. Another remnant that we've gotten some measurements on is G156. We've seen a few talks on that so far. So this is a color composite, so you're not able to see the WISE image too well, but there's a WISE 22 micron image that was made by my undergraduate student working with me, Jason Powell, of G156. And here is Girardi and Friesen's image in H-alpha along the very edge of G156. This is an old supernova remnant, and one of the things you learned about earlier is it seems to be on the order of 10,000 years or older. And these shocks over here, based on proper motion measurements of the X-rays, and in the optical and X-ray measurements, they've been able to determine shock speeds of around 500 kilometers per second for this. So here is where we obtained some spectra. So this is something that we're working on right now. Here's the image by Girardi and Fiesen, and here are all the positions along here where we got spectra. If you zoom up on this, there's one position of rather straight shock front here, which I call 1 and 2. These are the slits, and each one is something like 3 or 4 arc minutes long. This tells you how big this thing is. Very, very tiny. And then way up at the top in the north, there's a place where there's two crossing shocks where we obtained spectra over here, position 6. So here's the result of sitting for 6 hours on exposing on filaments in G156. And we were finally able to pull out the broad components in these. So now we can say we've detected them. These broad components over here, just to give you an idea, this is 10 to the minus 17 ergs per square centimeter per second per angstrom. So those of you who do optical astronomy can appreciate how faint that is. So what we did is we combined the spectra from positions 1 and 2, and that's your broad component width. And then way up in the north where they cross, it's only 235. So this already tells you that the shock is moving faster along that eastern side, and it's moving slower in the north. The broad to narrow ratios are 0.65 and 1.2. And what's curious is that this over here, once again, cannot be matched with any shock models that are known. The only thing we can quote is a range of shock speeds between unequilibrated and equilibrated. So it's somewhere in that range. And guess what? The work of Katsuda and Rob and all fall right in this range. So at least we're not crazy. But we're not crazy for that reason. Crazy for other reasons, but we have detected the broad component here. What's interesting is the position way up in the north, I was able to actually model and get an equilibration out of. It turns out beta down of 1 matches this broad to narrow ratio very well. And the shock speed's about 300. So this is all being put together into a paper to follow soon. So here's the image over here, the WISE image, 22 microns. There's the northern part of the remnant, and here's this side here. Here's this cloud that everyone was expecting that the remnant was running into, and it turns out that Katsuda et al. And now us, we've shown that it cannot be interacting with this. It's just at a completely different distance. So here's my conclusion slide. How far am I past my time? Can I read these bullets? Okay. Why don't I just stop right here, and I'll leave that up and take questions.
Okay. Well, we discussed this before, but I want to make a remark that actually last year I had an alternative idea on how you can modify the equilibration. And basically, it comes down to that the ratio between thermal energy and kinetic bulk energy changes. It's different also for protons and electrons. And only when you are at the Mach number of 40 to, say, 60, the energy of the electrons is dominated by the kinetic energy rather than the thermal energy. So there, actually, it goes off to an ME over MP ratio. And in between, you get a 1 over V squared or 1 over M squared relation between TE over TP. In reality, it looks like there's a sort of a turnover. So there must be some exchange at a shock front between electrons and protons.
And protons. Some mechanism.
Yeah. And it's basically a sort of kinetic thermodynamic theory. It's very simple. It doesn't involve any waves. They may be there, mm-hmm. and they may modify things, but this is sort of the basic, the minimum that I think you can get.
I think I'm going to, did I just turn this on? Okay, let me see if I can go back to this slide here. So this is showing the solar wind results. So here, Cassini went into the bow shock around Saturn, and as it flowed through that, and this is showing time here, and here's the frequency of the waves that it received, it went right through the bow shock. So it was able to actually measure upstream and downstream parameters and get what we call alphanic Mach numbers. So that's the ratio of the shock speed to the alphane speed. So the alphane speed here turns out to be an important parameter. So here, this shows the range of shocks that we have, and what you'll see is that most of these shocks, most of these shocks have Mach numbers between 4 and 16. And these are all done during mostly quiet solar wind conditions. And what they found is when they fit this, you notice there's a lot of big error bars in here, when they fit this, what they plotted over here is the alphanic Mach number, and here is the amount of heating the electrons get compared to the protons with the velocity normal to the shock front. And what they found is that relation, and I would refer you to the 1988 paper because they did a more detailed statistical analysis, they found that the ratio of electron to ion heating goes like 1 over the Mach number. And so if you take what we have and what Jaco's proposing, we're saying 1 over Mach number squared. So those don't actually really, those two trends, they don't line up. And I would point out one important thing about the shocks in the solar wind is that the reflected non-thermal distribution coming out of those shocks is not ultra-relativistic. We're not looking at TeV protons. We're looking at a few MeV. And the diffusion coefficient for those is entirely different than it is for out in the supernova remnants. And in addition to that, the temperature of the solar wind there is on the order of 100,000 degrees. And so the pre-shock conditions are considerably different than they are with the supernova remnants. Now, although it is tempting to take the Mach numbers that we have, remnants should be around a few hundred, and take that and say, okay, with the heating ahead of the shock, we can pull it all the way down to Mach numbers that are between 1 and 20. The slope of that relation, you also have to have it match the solar wind for that to work, and it doesn't. So the solar wind results, I mean, they should give, if the simple heuristic argument is correct, they should give the same relation as the remnant ones, and they don't. And so understanding why that's different is, I think, something important.
May I take the prerogative to of the chair?
Yeah.
Ask a question. Would you slide back to the one of the Morlino diagrams of broad line width versus shock velocity?
This one.
Well, yeah, that one would be fine. We actually have a poster out that Luke Hovey has done where we populate this curve with velocities determined in kilometers per second because we know the distance of the object. They're in the LMC. The distance modulus uncertainty is 0.05 to the LMC. It's really well known. So we populate that, and we have broad line widths for the full width half max broad line widths. So we have a whole dozen or so points that populate this this diagram, and I encourage you to look at the poster to see what the implications are.
Can I spill the beans? No.
I'm sorry?
Can I spill the beans on what the poster's results are?
Okay, I won't.
With your the intermediate component that you discussed, for what are the implications of that for the broad and narrow ratio? Does it count as part of the narrow, or do you really have to go back to square one?
Well, you're making a great point. So it turns out if you have like a shock like SN1006 and you really want to resolve that intermediate component from narrow, you need to do two sets of observations. One, a shell spectrum to get narrow from intermediate, and then a low res to get the broad. And so you need to sum the intermediate and the narrow together to get the total narrow component, and then compare that, because they do blend together. And if you don't have, if your spectral resolution is less than, if your velocity resolution is worse than like say 50 or so, they're gonna blend, or 100, they're gonna blend. And I think that's one reason why we were getting such low broad to narrow ratios for so long. The intermediate component was in there mucking things up. Now, what's interesting is the broad to narrow ratios in the Cygnus loop are also very low. So you start saying, whoa, is there an intermediate component in there too that's messing things up? Well, I don't know, because we don't have the data and nobody's modeled it. So somebody needs to do that.